"'Cat been at the cream?' Saffron demanded. Amber's ebullient mood was such a marked change from the days of gloom that had preceded it that she had to tackle her sister later that day as they worked side by side over the green cake cauldrons in Ryder Courtney's compound. Amber gave her a sweet but enigmatic smile and would not be drawn. That evening, an hour after curfew, Penrod Ballantyne was amazed to recognise Amber's voice arguing with the sentries at the entrance to his headquarters in the Gatling emplacement. He rushed out immediately, buckling on his sword hilt. "You silly child," he scolded her severely. "You know very well there is a curfew. You might have been shot." Amber had hoped for a warmer reception. "I brought you some green cake. I knew you must be starving." She unwrapped the small bundle she was carrying. "And one of Papa's clean shirts. I can smell your old one from here." Penrod was about to demand how she had learnt of his whereabouts, when in the light of the bull's-eye lantern he saw tears of humiliation in her eyes. But she blinked them back and faced him with her chin up. "Furthermore, Captain Ballantyne, I will have you know that I am not a silly child." "Of course you are not, Miss Amber," he relented instantly. "You took me by surprise. I just did not expect you. I apologize." She perked up. "If you give me your old shirt, I will take it back to wash it for you." Penrod found himself in a dilemma. With the threat of an imminent dervish attack on the harbour, he should not allow her to stay here another minute. For the same reason, he dared not leave the emplacement to escort her back to the palace, and he could not let her wander through the city alone after curfew. He could send Jakob with her, but he needed him at his side. There was no one else he could trust. He chose the lesser of all evils. "I expect that you will have to spend the night here. I cannot allow you to break curfew and go home alone," he muttered. Her face lit up with pleasure. This stroke of fortune far exceeded her remotest expectations. "I can cook you dinner," she said. "There isn't much to cook. So why don't you and I share your very generous gift of green cake?" They sat on his angareb in the dugout. There were no curtains to this alcove, so the gunners were involuntary chaperones as they nibbled the green cake and talked in low tones. It was the first time he had spent any time with her, and Penrod soon discovered that Amber was entertaining company. She had an impish sense of humour that appealed to him, and a quaint manner of expressing herself. She described her various travels with her father, which ranged from Cape Town to Cairo, and finally Khartoum. Then, abruptly, she fell silent, placed her chin on her hand, and considered him thoughtfully. "Captain Ballantyne, now that we've become friends, would you be civil enough to answer a question that has been troubling me lately? Nobody seems to know the answer."
"I am honoured that you consider us friends." Penrod was touched. "She was such a funny little thing. I would be delighted to render you any assistance I can."
"How do people make love?" she asked.
Penrod found himself deprived of words and the breath to speak them.
"Ah," he said, and smoothed his moustache to win time. "I think that it is done in various ways. There do not seem to be any fixed rules of engagement."
Amber was disappointed. She had expected more of him. Obviously, he knew as little as Rebecca.
"I suppose they kiss each other like you and I saw my sister kissing Ryder? Is that how they do it?"
"Indubitably." He grabbed thankfully at the opening.
"I think that is exactly how they do it." "I should think that would become rather boring after a while." "It seems to grow on some people," Penrod said.
"There is no accounting for taste." Amber changed the subject again with disconcerting suddenness.
"Did you know that Lucy, Ryder's monkey, has had babies?"
I had no idea. Boys or girls? What are they like?" He followed her thankfully onto firm ground. Minutes later, Amber's eyes closed. She subsided against his shoulder and, like a puppy, dropped into instant sleep. She did not stir even when he laid her on the angareb and covered her with the threadbare blanket. He was in a good mood, smiling to himself as he left her and went on his midnight inspection of the harbour defences. For once, every one of the Egyptian sentries was wide awake. Either they were stimulated by the proximity of the enemy, and their own exposure in this forward position, or their hunger drove away sleep. He found a comfortable place to sit on the forward firing platform and listen to the drums across the river. Their monotonous tempo became soporific, and he found himself nodding. He stirred guiltily. If Chinese Gordon finds me, I'll be up before the firing squad myself. He took a turn along the parapet and came back to his seat. He let himself relax and drift to the edge of sleep, but every few minutes he opened his eyes. He had trained himself to tread this tightrope without falling off it. Across the river, the drums fell silent. He opened his eyes again and looked up. Red Mars, the god of war, was hunting across the southern quadrant of the moonless sky, with Sirius the dog in leash. It was the darkest and loneliest hour of the night. He was close to the edge of sleep, but he kept his eyes open.
Penrod? Cool fingers brushed his cheek. Are you asleep?
He turned his head to her. He was touched that she had used his baptismal name. She must truly think of him as her friend. No, I am not, but you should be.
I heard voices, Amber whispered.
A dream, perhaps, he replied. There are no voices.
Listen, said Amber.
Faintly, he heard a dog bark on the west bank, and another answered it from Tutty Island further downriver. No dogs remained in the city. The last had been killed and eaten months before.
Nothing,
he shook his head doubtfully. But she seized his arm and her sharp little fingernails dug in painfully.
Listen, Pen, listen.
He felt his nerve ends jump tight, like the strike of a heavy fish on the deep-run fly. It was a whisper, so faint, so insubstantial on the night breeze that only sharp young ears could have picked it up. It came from far out on the river. Sound carries over water, he thought, and stood up swiftly and silently. Faint as the breeze in the palm fronds, he had heard the traditional word of command to lower and furl the lateen sail of a dhow as it came into its moorings. Now that he was straining his hearing to the limit, he heard the soft slap of bare feet on a wooden deck and the slatting of canvas. Seconds later came the creak of a muffled rudder in its yoke as the dhow put up its helm.
They have come, he whispered, and moved swiftly along the firing platform to alert each of his men. Stand to! Stand to your guns! The dervish are here! Hold your fire until my command!
The sergeant gunner stripped the tarpaulin off the gatling. The stiff material crackled softly, and Penrod hissed him to silence. He looked into the ammunition hopper that sat on top of the glistening weapon. It was filled to the brim, 600 rounds. He lifted the lids of the spare ammunition cases. They were all unlocked. At the hill of Isandlwana, when the Zulu impis had broken the British square, the spare ammunition cases had been locked and the officer who had the Allen key had ridden out on patrol. Every white soldier in the camp had died that day under the Zulu blades. Ryder Courtney had told him that his elder brother had been among them. Tonight the ammunition cases were unlocked, and the four Egyptian loaders were standing by to keep the hopper filled. He ran to the rear of the firing platform. The corporal of signalers, with a detail of four men, had their crates of rockets open and a line of 10 flares ready for firing in their launching brackets, nose cones pointed skywards.
Send up a flare at the first shot. Keep one burning in the sky until the last shot is fired. I want the whole area lit up like daylight, Penrod ordered.
There was no time for anything else. Penrod started back towards the forward firing platform to take command there. He could not trust the jittery Egyptians to resist blazing away at their first glimpse of the enemy boats before the dervish were disembarked upon the beach and well inside the trap. He tripped over Amber, who was at his heels.
Sweet Mary, I'd forgotten about you.
He caught her by the arm and dragged her to the rear entrance of the redoubt.
Run, he ordered.
You have to get out of here right away. This is no place for you now. Even the streets are safer. Run, Amber, and don't stop until you get home. He gave her a firm shove through the doorway to send her on her way, and did not wait to see if she had obeyed before he turned back towards the forward firing platform. Amber ran a few paces down the alley, then turned and crept back to the entrance of the redoubt.
She watched Penrod disappear into the darkness. "I am sick and tired of being treated like a baby," she whispered. She hesitated only a moment before she followed him. She moved quietly and self-effacingly along the back of the parapet so as not to attract the attention of the troopers who were manning the firing embrasures. "They're all too busy to worry about me," she thought. Her confidence swelled, and she hurried forward to look for Penrod. "What if he needs me? I'll be no use sitting in my bedroom at the palace." She saw his tall figure just ahead. Penrod was already standing at the parapet that overlooked the beach. The straw-filled decoys had been dragged away, and now live riflemen leant on the firing sills, peering down upon the dark beach. He had his drawn sword in his right hand. Amber felt a prickle of pride. "He is so brave and noble," she thought. She found a place to hide in a corner of the rear wall and sank down behind it. From here she could watch over him. A tight, brittle silence held all the men at the firing wall. Suddenly Amber realized how few of them were spread out thinly along the wall, 20 paces between them. These men did not seem enough to stop the hordes of the dervish. Then a man close to where Amber knelt whispered so softly that she could barely catch the words. "Here they come." His voice quavered with fear. The breech block of his Martini Henry snicked as he chambered around. He lifted the weapon to his shoulder, but before he could press the trigger, an open hand slapped across his face. As he reeled sideways, Penrod seized him by his collar and spoke close to his ear. "Fire before my command, and I will have you blown from the cannon's mouth," he promised. Al-Farouk's execution had left a deep impression on all the Egyptians who had witnessed it. Penrod pushed the man back to his position, and they waited. Then Penrod drew breath sharply. The first dervish boat glided in towards the beach below. As it touched the sand, a dark horde of Ansar clambered out into the waist-deep water and waded onto the narrow strip of mud below the walls. They carried their swords at shoulder height and moved with barely a sound. From the dark waters behind them appeared a flotilla of small dhows and feluccas, each packed with a mass of men. "Hold your fire!" Penrod strode back and forth along the parapet, keeping his puny force under control with his savage whisper. The feluccas and dhows kept coming in until the beach was packed with hundreds of Ansar. There was not room for all of them on firm ground, and the ones in the rear were still waist-deep in the river. Those in front began to rip down the barricade that blocked the entrance to the drainage creek. "Steady now! Steady!" Penrod exhorted them. Part of the barricade crashed down, and the dervish swarmed through. Their war cry went up. "There is no god but God!" "Volley fire!" Penrod shouted, and the rifles crashed out. The dervish rushed on through the hail of bullets. Then the first rocket soared into the night sky, and the masses of dervish swarmed like columns of ants in the weird greenish light. The riflemen fired down into them, but there were so many that their bullets had little effect. When the front ranks reached the harbour wall, they clambered up it, the rear ranks shoving from below. As they came over the top, the defenders thrust with the bayonets. Penrod strode along the wall, firing his new Webley pistol point-blank into their bearded faces. In his right hand he carried his sabre, and when the revolver was empty he slashed and hacked with the blade. The dead and wounded Ansar toppled back onto the comrades who were climbing up behind them. The Egyptian line was too flimsy to hold them in check much longer. All along the top of the wall, knots of dervish were gaining footholds. Their two-handed crusader blades hissed through the air with the sound of bat's wings. One of the Egyptians reeled back from the parapet with his right arm sliced off cleanly above the elbow. His blood was inky black in the light of the rockets. "Back!" shouted Penrod. "Fall back to the second line!" Even in her own terror, Amber was startled by how clearly his voice carried above the uproar. His men formed quickly into a skirmishing line, bayonets facing outwards, and they retreated backwards along the top of the wall. For a terrible moment, Amber thought she would be left behind, but she sprang up and ran like a startled hare. Instinctively, she knew that the Gatling emplacement was the strongest point of the defence, and headed for it. She reached it well ahead of Penrod and his men and scrambled to the top of the wall of sandbags. As she hung there, someone grabbed her arm from the far side and dragged her over. She fell on top of her rescue. He smelt of rotten fish heads and glared at her with a horrific squint, his face green in the light of the flares.
"Nazira will kill you with her bare hands if she finds out you are here."
He pushed her roughly into the dugout in the back wall, just as Penrod led his men back in a rush.
"Gatling gun up! Open fire!"
Penrod had selected the man on the crank handle of the gun for his strength and stamina. Sergeant Khaled was a colossal black man from one of the Nubian tribes of Upper Egypt. Men like him made the finest soldiers in all the army of the Khedive. He bobbed up and down like a marionette as he worked. The brightly burnished barrel spun like the revolving spokes of a chariot wheel. The flickering glare of muzzle flashes lit the parapet as brightly as a stage. With a sound like a giant ripping up a roll of heavy canvas, a continuous stream of bullets tore into the ranks of Ansar as they swarmed forward. The heavy lead bullets slogged into living flesh, and the ricochets screamed off the stone parapets, almost drowning the clamour of the dervish force. Traversing back and forth, the Gatlings scythed them down, piling heaps of corpses along the front of the wall. Those who followed scrambled over them and grabbed at the barrels of the rifles that aimed at them through the embrasures, trying to tear the smoking weapons from the hands of the defenders on the far side of the wall. The soldiers thrust at them with their bayonets, screaming with battle rage, and the dervish screamed back at the agony of the steel slicing deeply into their bodies. Then the barrels of the Gatling swung back and blew them away like the Khamzin wind. The last of the dervish tumbled off the revetment and lay in huddles or dragged themselves through the black slick of the creek bed. Sergeant Khaled straightened up, and the gun fell silent. His black face was split with a white and ferocious grin, and his barrel chest ran with rivers of sweat that gleamed in the green light of the flares.
"Reload!"
Penrod shouted, as he filled the chambers of his own revolver from the loops on his belt.
"Get ready for the next wave!"
The loaders came running up with the ammunition buckets, and the shiny copper-cased cartridges cascaded into the Gatling hopper. Other ammunition boys ran along the parapet, doling out paper packets of Boxer Henry ammunition to the riflemen. The water carriers followed them, squirting water from the nozzles of the skins directly into the parched mouths of the soldiers.
"Be ready for them. They are not beaten. They will come back through the creek again."
Penrod moved down the parapet, talking to the men. The trooper whose arm had been hacked off had died from loss of blood. They laid his body against the rear wall and covered him with a blanket. Penrod started back towards the Gatling to bolster the courage of Sergeant Khaled and his gunners, but as he passed the doorway to his dugout, he saw a small white face staring out at him.
"Amber, I thought you'd gone."
Now that she was discovered, she decided to brazen it out.
"I knew you didn't mean to send me away. Anyway, it's too late now. I have to stay."
He was about to debate this point with her, but from the depths of the creek bed rose the dread chorus of dervish war cries. The hordes poured back in a flood that filled the creek from side to side. Penrod drew the Webley from the holster on his belt and broke it open to check that it was fully reloaded. He snapped the breech closed.
"I know you can use this. I have seen you practicing with your father."
He thrust the weapon butt first into her hands.
"Get back into the dugout, climb under the bed. Stay there until this is over. Shoot anybody who touches you. This time, do as you're told. Go."
He ran back to the parapet. 200 Egyptian riflemen did not wait for his command to reopen fire. The volleys crashed down into the creek bed, and the Gatling ripped and rattled, a stream of spent cartridge cases spilling into a glistening mound on the floor of the redoubt beneath its carriage. A succession of coloured flares burst high above the arena, illuminating with garish light the dervish struggling upwards through the reeking mud. Their ranks were so closely packed that every bullet must strike. Surely mortal men must break under such punishment. Yet they came on, clambering over the torn and twitching corpses of their comrades, their multicoloured jibbas plastered with reeking black mud, never wavering. Each man trying to fight his way to the front rank of the attack, scornful of death, eager to seek it out in the smoking muzzles of the guns. But there was a line at the foot of the wall across which even their courage could not carry them.
The Gatling stopped them there, as though they had reached a wall of glass, building up taller piles of dead men. Wave after wave of warriors came on to add their own corpses to the growing heaps. Swiftly the creek was transformed into a ghastly charnel house. Then, as the attack wavered, the Gatling fire ceased.
"Captain! Stoppage!" Sergeant Khaled yelled. "The gun is jammed!"
As the import of those words struck the Egyptian troopers, horror dawned on their faces in the light of the flares. As the full extent of this disaster struck them, their fire dwindled, stammered, and fell silent. Even the Ansar in the creek were caught up in the spell. A weird and unnatural quiet fell over the battlefield, broken only by the groans and cries of the wounded. It lasted but a few seconds. Then a single voice spoke,
"La ilala ilala! There is but one God!"
It was a voice Penrod recognized. He looked down into the grisly creek bed and saw Osman Atalan in the first rank of the dervish horde. Their eyes locked. Then the battle cry went up from hundreds of throats, and the attack swept forward again. As though the wall of glass that had contained them was shattered, they clawed their way up the steep, treacherous bank of the creek towards the redoubt. The heads of the Egyptian riflemen turned as they looked back to find a line of retreat. Penrod knew that gesture well. He had seen it before, on the terrible day when the square broke at El Obeid. It was the prelude to flight and rout.
"I will kill the first man who breaks," he shouted.
But one ignored him. As he turned to run, Penrod stepped forward and thrust for his belly. The long blade of his sabre slipped in as though it had been greased, and the point sliced out through the back of the man's khaki tunic. He dropped to his knees and clasped the blade of the sabre with his bare hands. Penrod pulled out the razor-sharp steel between the victim's fingers, severing skin and flesh and sinew. The man screamed and toppled backwards.
"Stand your ground and keep firing,"
Penrod held high his blood-wet blade,
"or sing the same song as this cowardly creature."
They turned back to the firing embrasures and poured their volleys down into the mass of dervish clambering up towards them. Sergeant Khaled was hammering on the breech mechanism of the silent Gatling with his bare fists, leaving the skin of his knuckles on the sharp metal edges. Penrod grabbed his shoulder and pulled him aside. By the light of the flares, he saw the crushed cartridge case jammed in the jaws of one of the six cam-operated bolts. It was a number 3 stoppage, the most difficult to clear. There was a trick to it that Penrod had learnt from hard experience. He snatched the bayonet from the sheath on Sergeant Khaled's belt, and with the point of the blade worked to prise open the jaws of the bolt. The dervish came up the walls, climbing like squirrels up the trunk of an oak. The Martini Henry rifles fell silent as the attackers wriggled through the embrasures and grappled hand to hand with those Egyptians who had stood their ground. The Gatling's bolt was still jammed solidly. Penrod glanced up. At that moment, the fate of the city and all its inhabitants hung on him. One of the many myths that had built up around the image of General Chinese Gordon was that his voice could carry above the din of any battlefield. Penrod heard it now in the uproar of this inevitable disaster.
Number 2 gun! Open fire!
Penrod had never expected to welcome those harsh and hectoring tones. They carried clearly across from the secondary emplacement that Penrod had built in anticipation of just such a moment as this. His knees went weak with relief. Then he braced himself and turned his mind back to the jammed gun.